Welcome to the Fastcast, your place for all the up-to-date, more current, relevant, not laid out, fast pass.
You'll get it one day, John. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine.
Practice.
One day you'll get good at this.
I never will.
I'm Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
I'm Slowpoke number one, John Aglaitis.
Welcome, folks, to the Slowpoke's Fastcast.
Fastcast. That's the thing. Yep. We're here today to talk about all kinds of things. I'm here to talk about Vietnam. To be specific, Rising Storm 2, Vietnam.
Does that game talk about Vietnam?
It's set in Vietnam.
Yeah.
It is one of those quintessential old school 64 player based shooters.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So the reason,
so I guess it doesn't really talk about Vietnam.
No, not in the slightest.
So yeah, it doesn't really talk about Vietnam.
No.
It's just kind of set there.
Yes. And it's all about just running around shooting people. Okay, I gotta be honest. I'm not sold on the theme. I've never liked Vietnam as a theme. I feel like it's like, I guess as I age, I get more and more confused and uncomfortable with real wars in the settings
like
of games.
We kind of understand that, like, even wars that are set, even games set during, like, World War II, which is probably the most, like, noble war as far as public perception, it's still not that clean.
Yeah, yeah. It's not comfortable, but... Mm. What is
fantasy? Just set it all in fantasy.
What is comfortable about
it? Set it in space.
It's true. I don't know why everything should be space. What is comfortable about this game, for me, is the old school 32 versus 32 first person shooter.
But you say old. Isn't that what all the Battlefields have done forever?
Yeah, okay.
And by forever, I mean as recently as Battlefield 1.
This is true. The reason why I sort of say old school is it has the Rising Storm kind of games. They have a lot of... the developer made games like Orchestra, which is a very old World War II shooter. And it was all about, like, quote-unquote, realistic simulations of combat.
Yeah.
So there would be... when bullets whizzed past you, your screen would get blurry with shell shock and stuff like that.
Okay.
And it's like manual reloading of bullets. It's like one of these sim kind of games.
Okay. So when you say manual reloading of bullets, you've got to like manage how many bullets are in an individual magazine and then get those magazines into
If you want to check how many bullets you have, your character looks or feels the magazine and then you get a vague indicator telling you half.
And so this is all in this game?
This game came out this year, and they recently did a free weekend, which I would have just finished by the time we released this.
Yeah.
So fast. But it just felt really fun for me to play like what I feel like is an old school kind of shooter with the servers and this kind of stuff like that.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. Like, when we say old school in that way, it's almost not so much old school. It's more like non-budget, if you kind of get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, definitely.
It's like, it feels old school because you have the list of servers and whatnot because it's just hosted on some person's machine rather than having like central Xbox Live or PlayStation Network stuff and having that infrastructure there.
There's something that reminds me of my childhood when I see a custom server description with all of the rules on it.
Yeah, I kind of never liked that, and I still kind of hate it. Like, it's stuff like that is just breeding grounds for hackers.
Oh, yeah.
And when I say hackers, I obviously don't mean like, oh, they're going to get my credit cards. I mean like fuckwits who just ruin the fun by wanting to get the high score numbers.
Also low-key racist, because half the names are just slurs.
Well,
so
we can't really get on our high horses about racially sensitive environments when we're talking about Xbox Live, can we?
This is true. But anyway, that's what I've been up to.
Yeah, I have also had a pretty good week as far as consumption of culture and immersion in art goes.
Yep.
I've actually had a really good run. I think I'm like 7 days, 7 new pieces of art at this point.
Whoa.
So like I've kind of got a combo going here.
Yeah,
hopefully I'll be able to, I'm trying to continue it by finishing Telltale's Batman.
Yeah.
Because I found out like a week ago that game had the final episode released like 6 months ago, and I just had no fucking idea.
I picked that game up for $2.50.
Wow.
It's criminal. Like, it wasn't a sale.
I guess that just didn't...
I don't know what happened.
Yeah,
I don't know what...
Nuts. I paid like $20 for it.
Yeah,
like,
I paid...
the standard prices.
Hopefully, I just bought the first episode like a chump and didn't check. But yeah, I bought it for like really cheap.
But like, yeah, I haven't played a lot of that yet. This week, I finished the Adventure Zone finally. Yeah.
So this is like a role-playing podcast thing, right?
Yeah, this is a D&D podcast. It's by... If It's not the smartest thing in the world to talk about your competition, but it's by the My Brother, My Brother and Me trio and their dad. So Travis McElroy, Justin McElroy, Griffin McElroy, and Clint McElroy. Clint is the dad.
So many McElroys.
Yeah, it's just the McElroy boys. So they, like, 2 or 3 years ago started a D&D podcast. It's just like a bonus episode in one of their... It's like, oh, hey, we've got enough subscribers. Who wants to hear a D&D thing?
And then it kind of took off, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it took off like crazy. And
didn't they make a comic about it recently? Didn't we talk about that?
Yeah, we talked about the comic recently. Yeah. So after 3 years or whatever, they released the final episode 2 or 3 weeks ago. I didn't listen to it straight away because I'd been saving the whole final chapter to listen to it once.
Yeah, okay.
And I did, and it totally lived up to everything I wanted it to be. It was just really powerful and really like... just a very satisfying ending to that arc.
Yeah, I saw a few people on my Facebook wall comment about how emotional they felt the whole thing
was. Yeah, and it really is. Like, it's just a very positive, very progressive, just very... Like, it's such a perfectly put together narrative, and it's by a group of people playing D&D. And so that's the caliber of... narrative complexity and that kind of thing. I say narrative complexity, but the caliber of the story they're delivering is on par with and exceeds many movies and many TV shows and like multi-million dollar kind of endeavors. It's really awesome. I'm very, very satisfied with it. Check it out if you haven't, because it's free.
Yes, it is.
I also saw a play that a friend of mine put on, Navy Pier. It was pretty good. Unfortunately, by the time this comes out, I'm pretty sure the season will have run its course.
Oh, no.
But yeah, it was pretty good. Nice to see independent theater companies doing something that isn't, you know...
Shakespeare?
Yeah, it isn't underwhelming, basically. I've seen a couple of plays by this group before, and I've always had some pretty strong criticisms of the plays that they put on.
Yeah, we have hours and hours of recorded audio of just deleting
complaining. Yeah, that John's had to delete of me just snapping and going on rants.
Oh, it's so long.
But this one was very refreshing because it was actually pretty good. And, you know, it didn't fall into a lot of the problems that I felt... the previous script had. Now, I want to make that very clear as well. The theater company, the actors are amazing, the direction, the set design, all of that stuff, all the stuff they do is great.
Mm-hmm.
The scripts that they've chosen in the past have been really problematic in some really significant ways.
Yeah.
This one wasn't. So it was just really nice to be able to see what they do unfiltered by like poor that negativity that I've run into before.
Okay, well that's great.
Other quick stuff that I finished, Pyre, which also, amazingly satisfying ending. Mm. I've already gone on rants about that in previous podcasts.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I hope really good. It.
And Breath of the Wild as well. I finally finished that.
Finished.
Yeah.
So, like, you did the boss, the end, the game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I've done the vast majority of the side quests as well. Like, there's a couple that were just a little bit too tedious, but for the most part, I explored most of that world. I've spent a lot of time in there.
Yeah, that's and, a lot of game.
Like, I've never... There have definitely been points where I haven't played in like a week or so, but it's not like I played it for a month, then didn't touch it, and then finished it yesterday. It's been pretty constant kind of stuff to do in that. So, the ending, it feels very succinct for a game that was so grand.
Yeah.
But it was still fine. Like, it was still good. And overall, again, I'm really, really happy that with Breath of the Wild. I'm really, really happy with... the one game that is on the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah. What will you do now, David?
I don't know.
Maybe we'll figure out like, what can come up later.
But yeah, that's what I've been up to anyway.
Mm. Well, that's good. So, I have a question from a listener.
Hey! Like, we got one!
Like a person, yeah, I asked for it, and then the person has gifted us this question. It is Tom from the Facebook page has given us a question that I will now read verbatim. What games that you've played on Slowpokes would make decent movies/TV shows?
I want to make it clear that wasn't verbatim.
Yeah, I read that, I saw that you edited it.
Yeah, I changed it to make it a more succinct note. I think it ended with mini series was verbatim.
Anyway, this is a great question. Do you have anything off the top of your head?
So this is a fun question to answer. It's like I think that there's two parts to it. One is like, hey, let's play a fun game where we can, you know, figure out, oh, what would we like to see a movie? And that's a cool part of it. The other part of the question, which I think is the more meaty part of the question, is should games be turned into TV series and movies? Is there games that can be properly translated to that?
I think this reminds me of something I talked about when we were discussing Borderlands, the pre-sequel. Okay. No, Tales from the Borderlands.
Tales from the Borderlands.
Yeah, and I mentioned that I would like I would probably enjoy that as a TV series.
Yeah, I can see that working. But the problem, I think that the biggest problem is for me, it's not inflexibility. That's the wrong word for it. But when I play something that I think works, part of the reason I think it works is because it is a game. I mean, we mentioned just in the other episode we just recorded, there's a tendency for us to break down games into the gamey bits and games into the story bits.
Yes.
Whereas the art of games is much bigger than just the characters and the plot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the best way to answer the more simple part of this question is not to ask what games would make good movies, but what game worlds would be fun to set movies in. I think that's a much better way to ask that question.
Mm.
So the idea of doing a spin-off of, I don't know, I had so many examples and now I can't remember any of them.
That's awkward.
So the having a spin-off, like having a, if you were to make a World of Warcraft movie, right?
For instance.
The World of Warcraft movie that was made is not great for a whole range of reasons. I don't want to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to have a story that you were like, okay, let's do a movie set in the Warcraft world, or let's do a movie set in the world of The Last of Us or something like that.
Yeah.
That I think is much, because you have so much more flexibility and you can create characters from the ground up. You can tailor the story to the medium of film or TV without having to lose stuff that's already established.
I get what you mean, but it's kind of what you're saying. Like, what that sounds like to me is like, well, you just take a premise and then you make something good.
Basically, yeah.
And like, you're right. Okay.
Yeah.
But I feel like you could do that with anything.
Yeah. That's not a bad point. Like, what I guess I'm trying to say here is that the difficulty of turning a game into a movie or a TV show is that the game is already a game.
Yes.
You know, I think Jim Sterling was the person who said this, and it's so obvious, but I didn't think of this specifically until he said it. When we adapt a book into a movie, we're adding stuff. We're adding visuals. We're adding cinematography. We're adding acting. We're adding these artistic skills. When we adapt a game or a book or a movie into a game, we're adding ludonarrative, we're adding gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
When we take something to a game and make it into a movie, we're removing things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's actually a very relevant part of why some of this stuff falls so flat when you have games turned into movies, because we don't realize how much of our investment in a game is not the plot and is not the actors.
Yeah, no, definitely. Especially with some of the games that get chosen to be movies.
Yeah.
They're very gameplay focused. Like the Assassin's Creed movie that came out recently is a perfect example. Assassin's Creed, to me as a series, is a very satisfying gameplay loop with a ridiculous story, right? That's just bonkers. And that's almost, it like, is like, you'd have to cut to make that a movie.
And this is the thing that sucks about that, though, is that if you had have asked me before that movie came out, I would have said Assassin's Creed. Like, if you had to ask me what, if there's one gun to your head, you have to pick one game franchise to turn into a movie, Assassin's Creed is such an obvious example, because you can make that exciting. But the problem is the person who made that movie had no fucking idea what they were doing.
So for me, when I think about converting properties and stuff like that, it's about playing with strengths.
Yeah.
The things you do, you have to do them to emphasize strengths. So if you're going to take a game and make it a movie and remove elements from it, you need to use the medium of a film to enhance the experience, to tell something interesting. But what normally happens is you just watch some things happen on a screen from a game world.
Yeah.
Right? That's like, oh, look, it's the person from the game world doing some things.
There's a connectivity that's lost. I think that's the most important thing, because there are so many movies, so many games that people mock for basically being movies. Metal Gear Solid 4, The Last of Us, Uncharted, all of them, right? Yeah. The strong criticisms is they're basically just busy work between cutscenes.
Yeah.
And so, but even then, even though the gameplay elements are for me, not actually the most interesting part of a game like The Last of Us, that the narrative and the character work is the strength of that game, I'm disconnected. And all I would be able to think if I was to watch a Last of Us movie is how I just kind of feel just cut off and just a little bit isolated, because there's something about having that controller in your hand and being Joel and being Ellie rather than watching Joel and watching Ellie. Definitely. Even if you don't have narrative decisions that you can make. When you come to... That said, though, I want to make it very clear. There are lots of people out there who are like, oh, you can never make a good video game movie. There are clear examples of that not being true. The Dead or Alive movie is actually very good, you know?
That was a surprise.
Yeah, and
my favorite one's the Silent Hill 1 movie.
I haven't seen that.
I watched that after listening to a podcast about it, and I quite enjoyed it. It's a pretty good horror film.
And some people like the Resident Evil movies. I mean, they've been hugely successful.
See, I think, to me, the Resident Evil movies work because they go into camp.
Yeah, they are good for the reasons any schlocky zombie movie
is
good.
It's like, I would love to watch, like, a Doom miniseries that's just 20-minute episode of violence, and there's, like, five of them. It's just, like, a whole vignettes of violence and fighting.
Yeah.
And it's just over-the-top metal for 20 minutes, like a Metalocalypse
video. And that could work. And it's like, what you're kind of getting at, though, is not overreaching, right? One other thing that's really worth bearing in mind is that although the vast majority of movies based on video games have been unsuccessful, there are a large range of game-adjacent movies that are very successful. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Wreck-It Ralph are two examples that are very obvious. Tron is another one. So there are plenty of game-themed movies that work really, really well. And I think, again, it comes back to that idea of freedom, that, like, anytime you lock yourself into something, I just don't think that's a great place to be. We are much better now at adapting stuff to screen than we have been in the past. And part of the reason we are better at that is because of, I think we understand that level of freedom. I think Movie Bob said this about why the Netflix Marvel shows don't really work, but the Netflix Marvel movies work very well, is that they try to avoid painting themselves back into a corner as far as continuity and stuff is concerned. Yeah. So the movies play a lot looser with continuity than the Netflix TV series did. And by the time everybody realized that Iron Fist was a piece of garbage, they'd already committed to the Defenders being all about Iron Fist and Iron Fist's bullshit.
Yeah.
You know? So that's another problem as well. But God, the Assassin's Creed one really kills me. I could talk for hours about how wrong that movie was at doing the Assassin's Creed thing, and how much better it would have been if I had written the script.
What's always interesting to me about those movie remakes is how they, like, focus on weird things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know. I just think about strengths and stuff like that.
You think that, like, they focus on the wrong elements.
Yeah. Like, for me, like, an Assassin's Creed movie is about Altair or whatever, or an assassin doing assassin things, and then at the end the obvious twist occurs, which is, like,
The Assassin's Creed movie seemed to think that the Assassin's Creed was about running on rooftops and the chase sequences.
Honestly, I haven't played Assassin's Creed since Assassin's Creed 2, so I don't even know what it's for.
But, like, the movie, it's just, like I said, I'm not going to talk about it because that's a trap that we're going to get stuck in. Do we want to... Is there anything else you think we can add to the listener question, or do you want to move on to news?
I mean, I was going to say Mass Effect would be interesting, but I've already watched Star Trek, so I don't need to know.
Yeah, and that's what I'm... That's like, this is such a generic thing that you could say about anything. Why do we need it to be based on a game? If you like the game, why do you need that to be copied to something else? And if you want to make a cool sci-fi, why do you have to remake Mass Effect that already exists?
This is true, but I didn't just realize that one of our games we've done is Invisible Ink, and I would love to see a TV series set in that world of weird espionage.
We talked a lot about how that world felt very underrealized, and so I think you've just described any generic noir, you know?
Like, and then again, I feel like I'm just on my way to make a very bad TV series.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say, to just wrap it all up, is that there's no reason these things need to be tied. You summed it up very, very well. You start with a premise and then make something good. That's what making art is.
Yeah.
There's no reason that premise needs to be predicated by a different form of art that already exists.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about some new stuff. So one thing I do want to mention, which is kind of cool, kind of uplifting. Obviously, there's a hurricane in Texas, USA at the
moment. Hurricanes are uplifting.
Don't do that. You know where I'm going with this. So that's obviously very sad, but as always in times of tragedy, there are people who are trying to help, and that is... That, you know, that's nice. That's nice to see. It's
people
helping
is nice.
The silver lining of our darkest moments is there are people to help us out of it. Games Done Quick is doing a thing. They're doing a quick doing games for the relief of that hurricane. If you've been thinking about donating, why not do it whilst watching some people do games really, really fast?
Sounds great.
Just raising awareness about that. I thought it was important.
Yeah, there's some really good charities out there that are video game related and adjacent. So.
Yeah, and also there are plenty of charities that aren't. I just that was the one that was the most relevant to what we talk about.
Most definitely.
But yeah, good on them.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized the unfortunate parallel that we've got there. I could have gone with a segue, but I won't.
Yeah.
A new entry in the Life is Strange series of games has come out.
Yes.
It has a subtitle.
Yeah, the subtitle's Beyond the Storm.
Yeah. Before the Storm.
Before
God, you're so bad at names.
I really am.
So this is a prequel to Life is Strange. Came out literally, I think, when I say yesterday as of recording, the 1st of September.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you going to play that?
I'm so... Oh, it's so weird, right? Because I love the character of Chloe.
Yep.
And this is focused on her experiences sort of from all the marketing I've seen. But I'm just not... There's nothing just super exciting that's jumping out for me to experience it.
Yeah, so...
It's not made by the same studio. It's a prequel for like a chapter that I don't really need to be fleshed out. I'm just like...
I'm going to play it because I'm curious. If for no other reason than I'm curious.
That's why, right? I would play it, yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to play it straight away. But Life is Strange was a really, really good game. I think it was the second game that we covered on the show. I thought that was an amazing piece of art. I'd like to see this. Like you said, it's made by a different studio. I don't know if the actor is it Ashley Birch who plays
Wasn't
Chloe?
There something about how it wasn't her because of some sort of strike?
But I don't even know if I'm saying it's... like
not sure.
I'll have to look into who's playing Chloe.
Yeah.
But we're talking about... I read something about some kind of back talk system. So they're taking the dialogue system a level deeper. So I'd be curious to see that.
Interesting.
It's Life is Strange. I'm going to give it a go. I just haven't yet.
Yeah.
One thing that I did think was interesting while I was looking into this is... how predictable we can be sometimes.
With reviews and stuff?
Yeah, if you go on, I think it was Steam, and you look at the aggregate reviews, 10 out of 10, overwhelmingly positive. But if you go to like more conservative review places, it's like 5.5 out of 10, not a game, just a walking simulator. And it's just like, stop.
Well, you know... as we know,
both frustrate me. Both ends frustrate me. Like the people who are like, "Fuck this! This is bullshit. It's not a real game." They're much more frustrating. But the fact that it's a 10 out of 10, and there's no way that people could have played it yet to review it and give it the 10 out of 10. You know?
Well, I mean, all we care about is trying to find perfect things, and nothing can ever exist on a spectrum.
We've talked about this before, but it all comes down to the way people assert their own identity through what they buy and what they play.
Yeah.
And that always makes me a little bit uncomfortable. Like, Life is Strange is amazing. I'm so glad it exists. I'm so glad there are people in the world who can identify with that and are given a chance to be identified with characters in a way that, you know, games don't generally give them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to sound like I'm shitting on like all these SJWs or whatever, but what I'm saying is that I'm disappointed with what makes me concerned is when people
use things as like
fit themselves to the things rather than
they're like
enjoying the things because they feel they fit.
Rather than I like this because of X, it's I like this. Full stop.
Yeah,
it's like this is who I am. I'm a person who likes this thing. You know, I'm a person who loves Life is Strange. I'm a person who hates Life is Strange.
Yeah, it's when people start to defining themselves by what they like. And I've talked about loot box before, but it's why loot box is successful. It's because the reason a box full of random crap, people are consistently happy to get it, is because we are sublimated to consumerism and because we are easy to predict in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me very uncomfortable. Especially, I didn't mention this, I played Subsurface Circular this week, and that has a lot of themes about the modern world in a whole bunch of different ways, but the freedom of thought and stuff like that is very big in there. And
it's good. I always love it when people tie robots into that kind of stuff because it's like, oh, they have free will. Do they have free will? Do we have free will? I don't know.
It's okay. So Mike Bithell, I've not played Volume. That's coming up, right?
I'm pretty sure it's on list somewhere.
So I haven't played Volume, and unfortunately, I won't get to play it until we do it for the podcast. But Thomas Was Alone is amazing. Mm-hmm. It's such a good game.
Yeah.
Subsurface Circular is very short. I think it's only like a 2 hour long game.
Yes.
I took longer.
Mm-hmm.
But for what it is, it's incredible. Like, I was talking about
it. I think people have sort of said it in a bit of a. It's kind of like a text adventure.
Oh, yeah.
Dressed up with a 3D engine behind it.
Yeah, I think that calling it a. I would call it like any other dialogue based narrative game. Like, I get why people say text adventure, but.
The game is playing to its strength.
Yeah.
Which is its writing.
It's so, so good. There's a thing that they put up about, you know, oh, please don't reveal anything after the third chapter for spoilers.
Very
and whatnot.
Polite.
And yeah, it wasn't demanding. They even said in there that, like, you know, feel free to do what you want. We're not going to oblige you, but at the very least, please put a spoiler warning up if you do stuff after that. So it's very pleasant. And it wasn't marketed basically at all. It just kind of came out. I think it's $6.
Yeah. Reasonably priced.
It's so good. Mm-hmm. It is so amazingly good. So if you are interested in narrative story stuff and you like, especially if you like Bithel stuff from the past, check it out.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a weird sort of segue. More newsy type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds. We talked about them in our last Fastcast, I think.
Yes.
Recently hit another popularity milestone. They overtook Dota 2 as most concurrent Steam users for a weekend. Dota 2 is back on top now.
Where it belongs.
Dota 2 is
Dota! I haven't played.
I have played a lot of MOBAs, Dota 2 and the original Dota, hated them. Like, I wrote off MOBAs as a whole for so long because Dota was the one people kept telling me to play. It's just it's too brown and too slow and too big and too grindy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, also, like, I don't want to... Okay, so for me, MOBAs are sports. Right?
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, like, if we talk about esports and what they are now, oh, that's something else we should talk about as well—the Olympics thing. Mm-hmm. But MOBAs are the first thing that come to mind when you say esports to most people, I think.
And to me, it feels like a sport because it's like I get it, I get what a MOBA is.
Yeah,
but like I don't want to learn how to play it. Right? I appreciate it, but it's like it
the
feels
perfect
like,
summary of what a sport is to nerds.
Yeah, it's like I don't want to practice. I don't want to.
It's cool.
Learn
I like understanding the rules. I don't want to have to get good at it.
I get it. Right? It's just like that's why I don't play it because it's just like you know. It's just like, I don't want to have to get into the practice of...
Yeah, and understanding the ever-shifting meta and all of that kind of stuff.
I've never understood metas. I just read guides.
Yeah,
them.
But PlayerUnknown Battleground is... we were talking about before, like, old-school shooters. It's very much more like an old-school shooter. So it's very interesting to see that spike in the ways that it has. We've already talked about its popularity.
And it reminds me a lot of DayZ.
All of those kinds of games. And I still haven't played it yet. And I know... For me, $30 is just a bit much. Like, I'm curious, but I'm not $30 curious at the moment.
I'm cash poor right now.
Yeah.
So, like, dropping $30 is just irresponsible.
But if I got, like, I don't know, like, a whole group together or something, and everyone was like, yeah, dude, we've got, like, six people. We're totally going to... We've got a night set up. Maybe we'll all do it as a LAN at a house.
I think this is the second time you've, like, put a call out there to try and get people to get together to do this. I feel like you put your feelers out there, David.
Yeah, to say putting a call out again is a little bit strong because it might very well happen where five people are like, hey, join us for Pug. And I'll be like, oh, it's still $30 though. But one thing I think is interesting about this is that it was a temporary overtake.
Mm.
For me, and not having played the game, but having played many games, MOBAs are part of... I think an evening routine for a lot of people. When I played League of Legends, that was something I did basically every night.
When we played League of Legends.
Yeah, I played it long after you did. So
yes, it's true.
And like, you know, MMOs and stuff like that, they fit into that a little bit every day kind of camp. Whereas for my taste, I imagine PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds would be more of a event, you know, like it would be, hey, Saturday afternoon, guys, are you guys going to be online for this? And so that's where I feel like it makes sense that it overtook it on a weekend and then immediately dropped back down as soon as the week started.
Especially if you're playing with friends.
Yeah.
Because, like, organizing a herd of people is just difficult.
Yeah.
And weekends are exactly for that in our society.
That's the reason the calendar works the way it does.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to talk about this Pokemon thing?
Oh, this is amazing. So, Nintendo's releasing Pokemon Gold and Sun?
Gold and Silver, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know why I wrote Gold and Sun. That's on me.
Yeah. So all the Pokemon games have really complicated names. I don't know if this is one of the remakes.
Gold and Silver was a Pokemon. It was a Game Boy Color.
I know that because I had Gold. But yeah. I assume they're releasing the remake in updated version. Yeah, on the
3DS.
On the 3DS. And they originally were going to release on the eShop. And then they decided to bring it out in stores. But they're not actually selling a cartridge.
So... this is the it was originally going to be an eShop only release, and then they would go like, oh, but if you want, you can go to retail and you can buy it just like you would your old fashioned Pokemon games back in the early thousands and the late 90s.
You know, you can crack that plastic case open.
But this is a cardboard box that is supposed to replicate the original Game Boy Color and Game Boy Game cardboard boxes.
Right.
With nothing in it. It has a code for the online download. And I don't even think it has a manual in there, so you can go and buy a bit of cardboard.
So, here's the thing. I can understand people, especially if you've been playing games for ages, in the boxes and putting them on your shelf. I can understand that kind of collector's appeal.
Yeah.
Right? And I even know, I know indie developers who've put out printed home boxes for your games. Their games are digital release only, and you can print out boxes with a unique artwork.
That's on your shelf. That's kind of fun.
Blendo Games does this with some of their.
So the idea is
games.
You would put the cover inside a DVD case or whatever that you already have,
if you want, or you just print off onto cardboard and then just fold it up and have a.
Oh, so it would be a cardboard box.
Yeah,
okay.
But you can do either, of course.
Yeah.
Right. There's just something weird about a company like Nintendo selling an empty cardboard box with a code in it.
Yeah.
That takes this into, like, a weird space. Do they ship them flat-packed? Does the... does the store have to fold them
themselves? Yeah, I haven't even thought about
that. Do they ship them pre-folded? So is that just a box full of boxes that are empty?
Yeah, it's just a box full of air.
Do they have to put the code into the box, or is the code printed in the box?
The other thing that's worth mentioning about this is that the cover of this box, it's not the original Game Boy box's art.
What?
It's the original art with a overlay, like, sticker or banner or something that says 3DS version, so it's not even really a collectible item.
Weird. Yeah, this is why I would just say to people, go on the web.
Yeah.
You will find a JPEG somewhere. Print that off and take it yourself.
Go on Facebook and say, man, I sure love my Nintendo golden silver box that I have in my house, definitely.
I swear I heard someone...
That's all anybody wants it for, so that other people can think they have it.
I can't remember where I heard this, but I have the feeling that you can buy original copies of Gold that aren't that expensive.
Yeah.
That have the original
box.
Yeah,
I think I heard that as well.
Just go buy them on eBay.
The thing that I find kind of bizarre about this is that it fits into a theme of Nintendo kind of doubling down on their whole wear a collectible kind of jam at the moment.
Yeah.
So we, John and I,
yes,
are lucky enough to live in Australia.
A sunburnt country.
Yeah, a sunburnt country. No, we live in Australia, which is generally considered to be part of the Pacific region, part of Oceania, part of a whole bunch of other...
neighboring.
The PAL regions.
Yes.
However you group us together, we almost always fall in with Japan.
Yeah.
And so we tend to be fine with some of this stuff.
Yeah, pretty much.
So a lot of people have been upset online because they live in America.
Yeah.
And haven't.
And also, apart from just living in America.
Apart from just all of the other reasons why they have plenty of reasons to be upset. The SNES Classic pre-order has been just a fucking disaster. And the NES Classic pre-order prior to that was also a disaster.
Mm.
Whereas, and so I've been reading this and I've been like, what are people talking about? What's the deal with this? Because for us here.
Totally fine.
The thing was announced, and I think like the day after EB, JB, all of them, they were taking pre-orders for it.
Yeah.
And we can get into the pre-order shit another time where I'm all like, should you be taking a pre-order for an item when you don't know how much you're even going to charge for it? But we had the opportunity, and so we weren't scrambling for it. Whereas in America, it seems like it's been like this Black Friday bullshit where they haven't, like, since it was announced, it was only put up for pre-order like a couple of days or maybe a little over a week ago from the time of recording. And it was like announced at 3 a.m. And they were saying that some sites within 3 minutes of it being opened, it was closed. And I don't know enough about how that's laid up, but how it's all set up in the States because I don't live there. But from what I understand, a really large portion of people who are in a position to know about this kind of stuff are talking about it as like, yeah, it basically is, if you set it up in this way, the only people who are going to be able to buy it are scalpers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is scalper heaven.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is people just reselling these for $300 or more the day after. Honestly, the whole thing is just like a big question mark to me, because you talk about it, it's like, Nintendo's already done this. They did it with the classic.
The NES Classic.
Yeah, the NES Classic.
Or the NES Mini or whatever they call it.
The NES Mini, Classic, whatever. They've already gone through this whole thing.
Yeah.
With that and the problems they had with pre-orders and all that kind of stuff. You think they would have learnt something, like a lesson or...
But this is the question. So Jim Sterling complains about this. I say complains about this. Covers this a lot. Calling it complaining is selling it way short.
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't just entitlement. You kind of have to sit back and go, why is a company doing something like this? You have to ask that question from a critical perspective. And it basically breaks down into two zones. Either one, for want of a better term, it's incompetence.
Yeah.
They want to be able to give as many people who want to buy these things as they can, but they're just unable to.
Yeah. Physical manufacturing limitations. It happens
maybe
all the time.
There's a strategic decision in there, but for some reason they can't give it to everybody they want.
It actually happens surprisingly often with like microchips and processing and the way China and manufacturing works. It's not as uncommon.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of insight on that. The other option is that they're doing it deliberately. For whatever reason, they're trying to position this product as a collector's item or something like that. And I think you mentioned this before. Why would they do that if they're still charging so little for the console? Generally, when people create an artificial scarcity, they do it so that they themselves can profit.
When I think of collector's editions for games, like the $400 video games collector's editions for like an Assassin's Creed, the statue of questionable quality.
Yeah.
Right? That's the way that they're charging it, it's like,
yeah, they big do money. That to make more money,
yeah,
right?
Which is fine. That's what businesses do.
Yeah.
Right?
No one's obliged to buy anything they don't want to.
Yeah. Cultural implications aside.
Yeah.
But like, this just seems like it's real narrow price. Like,
and I think that if we are going to consider it from that second perspective, they're doing it deliberately. I think that the only logical thing I can think of is that the image and the, like, the prestige of, not the prestige, but the this moment and the publicity of everyone wants this thing, but not everyone can have it. And so many people want it so bad that for some reason that image is desirable to the company.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this before the episode because you made a very reasonable counterpoint, which is that this is bad PR.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people would consider this to be bad PR.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the very Western news sites I listen to, a lot of people are complaining about it. And I feel like this like could be a cultural thing.
Yeah, like maybe in... Because the classic thing that people quote is that in Japan, if you fall asleep at your desk, you're considered a good worker because you've obviously worked so hard that you need to take a nap. And so that's almost like that's very bizarre to people who live in the West, where if you were to fall asleep at work, you're a lazy fuckhead. In maybe, and this is complete speculation, but maybe from Nintendo's perspective, there's a different take on this thing that, like, if everybody wants something, then it must be worth having. That if everybody wants this thing from this company, then that company must make good stuff. Maybe there's a PR play in that.
Because I'm just so used to the Kickstarter way of thinking, where you go, give us your money and we'll make you a thing.
It could also be, I think that personally, if you were to put a gun to my head and ask me, which is it that they are failing to deliver or if they're deliberately abstaining from delivering, I think that the failing to is the more reasonable one. And I think it's a sort of this, you know, I don't know what the internal politics are like. Maybe certain people are like, yeah, we can do this. We don't want to waste a whole bunch of resources on it. You know, we've got to get into factories and all this kind of thing. It would make more sense from that perspective why America is so disproportionately incapable of meeting pre-orders compared to like us. And it's better here than it is in the UK, but it's still better in the UK than it is in the US.
Especially because with the SNES, there's a different American version compared to the European areas.
You said that before the show, and I was just like, really? You really think the plastic case it comes in makes a difference? Maybe it does.
Well,
that might be the production bottleneck.
When you remember these plastic things, you got to make a cast, you have to make a specific mold, you have to do the proofing, right? And you have to do that twice, but only for one limited market.
Yeah.
Right? That's expensive.
It's also like, it might be a regional thing. Maybe their strategy is, okay, let's do a certain number of consoles for each region. And because America has a disproportionately high population for its size compared to most other nations in the world. Maybe that's another problem. I don't know. There's so many things that could be factors here. And I don't want to sit here and be one of those people who's like, fuck Nintendo, they're fucking assholes. But I do definitely empathize from the consumer perspective of why.
This is an unknowable puzzle.
Yeah. Right?
It is an enigma.
Why Nintendo? Why is that?
And we'll never know. And it pains me so much. There's no way they'd tell us. It's a company. Why would they share their secrets? And why would, especially if it was incompetence, which I don't know. We don't know if it is. But if it was that, why would you tell anyone that? That doesn't make any sense. Right? But like, it's so unknowable. And that's why it's so tantalizing.
And I think there are other companies that have different public relations strategies where this wouldn't be. I think that's part of why people are frustrated, is because we don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was as simple as, look, this is a niche little product, we're a big company and we have to dedicate a lot of time and resources to other things. We thought this would be nice. We thought people might want it, but we can't make this our whole strategy, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even something that simple might actually put a lot of people at ease and just alleviate that.
Even the phrase, it's like, we just can't.
Yeah.
Like, for the company to just go, Look,
we know there's a lot of you who want them. There's only so many we can make.
I feel like Nintendo isn't doing that. They just stay they're just silent about it. And
it might be like, because we haven't even considered stuff like shareholders and stuff like that. Maybe all of the frustration and desire that people on the ground have is irrelevant, because the people who invest money are all like, wow, Nintendo is pretty popular.
Yeah. Also, maybe they don't want to affect the image too. They don't want to become a company that just makes retro consoles forever. Maybe it's a whole branding thing as well, part of a marketing image.
As much as we can talk about the frustrating elements of Nintendo, I think that it is always worth remembering that there is truth to the idea of them as the Willy Wonka of video games. That, like, they've been around for a very long time, despite a lot of the conservative practices that they might have in some areas. There are other areas in which they are surprisingly progressive. And, you know, the idea of what the Switch is would have seemed completely inviable before it happened, you know? And so little things like that. I want to make it clear that I don't want to be one of these people who...
It's the curiosity of the unknown that has us so enraptured.
Yeah, and I don't want to be one of these classic internet games people who's like, oh, this company did a shitty thing once, fuck them and everything they do forever, you know?
I
think that things are just more complex than that.
And yeah, it's not like they sold baby formula to people in third world countries like Nestle.
Yeah.
That's why I don't buy Nestle products. That's a bit different to someone not selling you a games console.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, for example, I don't buy Nestle products because they did a horrible thing once.
And it's not like, you know, the Arkham Knight bullshit or something like that, where people tried to make, you know, that whole thing was just like, hey, you guys are lucky to buy a broken product. We'll maybe fix it later. And then they never fucking did, you know? Like, that's different to, we didn't meet demand. Other stuff that's a little bit more positive Nintendo-wise is that they did a showcase recently. We won't spend a lot of time on this, but basically they did a couple of indie games that are coming to
the Switch
in the next sort of 6 to 12 months.
Hmm.
Stuff that stuck out to me was, first and foremost, probably Kentucky Route Zero is going to get a Switch version.
I always forget that the last episode for that hasn't come out.
So I used to feel very guilty about playing Kentucky Route Zero. Sorry, not playing Kentucky Route Zero for so long after its release. The game isn't released yet in some manners of thinking. Like, the first episode was like 2013 or something.
Yeah, I was always kicking myself because I hadn't completely finished it. And I realized I couldn't have because it hadn't been finished.
Yeah, exactly. So this news is big news for Kentucky Route Zero more generally, as it is for the Switch. So the Kentucky Route Zero is going to have the fifth episode released on PC.
Yep.
At the same time as all five episodes are released on PS4, Xbox, and the Switch.
That's nice.
I don't know if I've bought it yet, but if I can only get it, I might get that on the Switch.
Why not? You know? It's a perfect place to play it.
Yeah.
I think it's something that Laura Dale always talks about. If I can get something portable, I'll get it.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Why wouldn't I get it so I can play it wherever I want?
And like, there are occasionally little things where like, maybe I'll just see how it compares, because the hardware elements of a Switch are very different from the other hardware options out there. I generally also prefer PC, generally, because there's something about portability is nice.
Mm.
For some things. Yes. Other things, I want to be okay. The door is closed. The lights are off. I am in the magic circle now.
Yeah.
I am in the movie theater to play this game that needs to be seen in the video game equivalent of a movie theater, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's it can go either way. They also announced a couple of other little things that were fun. Golf Story is a fun little art. It's kind of cool. It's very cute.
What did you say? It was like a
SNES era
role playing kind of game
RPG where it's like got the top down thing. You've got your little you've got the main village and that kind of thing. But instead of going around and killing monsters, you play golf.
Oh, it's so cool.
And it's got that whole like Stardew Valley sort of look to it. And
there was a DS series of games that were all about there were soccer games, but they were built like an RPG system.
Oh, cool.
Where you would go around town and recruit different people and then have different soccer stats.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
And like the idea of a golf game that's kind of like a JRPG with all those RPG elements, that sounds adorable.
And this is the exact kind of game I would definitely want to play on a portable system like Switch. Yeah. There was another game that I thought was very much worth mentioning. I might be mispronouncing this, but Mulaka is a game based on the Tarahumara indigenous culture, which is indigenous people local to, like, I think what we call northern Mexico now. Yeah. And so this is a game about, like, their folklore and, you know, you becoming a warrior and part of the tribe. And it's sort of an action-adventure game.
Cool.
Nowhere near the scale of a Zelda game, but kind of like, you know, puzzles and combat and exploring the world and that kind of thing. So that's always fun. I really like to see when smaller stories give an exposure like that.
So this next game has a great name, Battle Chef Brigade. Right?
I knew you'd like this one.
It just jumps out to me. It's just like, oh, this sounds weird.
So if Battle Chef Brigade, if the title doesn't grab you, maybe the entity who is involved in the production would Adult Swim.
I'm such a fan of Adult Swim's games. They produce such interesting and wacky games.
Mm.
Actually, the Cartoon Network, Cartoon Network.
Do they do Rick and Morty? Is that them?
No.
Okay.
Who knows? So Cartoon Network as like a corporate entity has always had a history of really interesting Flash games, which is something to explore another time. And then it went to Adult Swim and making regular games. And I have loved all the games that they've put out. One of the ones that I said it before. Do you remember what it was called?
Devil's Lawyer or something like
Devil's
that.
Advocate.
Devil's Advocate. Oh, there we go. That's a much better name than the one you gave to me, which was Devil's Lawyer.
Yeah. So there was a game they put out that's like an Android iOS game called Devil's Advocate, I'm pretty sure it is, where you play as a lawyer. And it's like a turn-based combat thing where you fight the opposing lawyer to protect your plaintiff, but who's obviously in the wrong because you're a super corrupt lawyer and it's like positioning you as the bad guy.
Yeah.
And it's just adorable and very well written.
And that's what I love about games like that is that you don't... The great thing about games is the second you involve competition or gameplay or success into something, it's very easy to make comments about the state of the world without having to make them explicit.
Mm.
Prison Architect is about, you know, a for-profit prison. And without ever having to use any one word of explicit dialogue, you are exposed to several conflicts of interest because your job is to make money and make a successful prison.
Yeah.
In a game like that, you're an adversary, you're a lawyer in the adversarial legal system, and without ever having to actually make an explicit thing, it makes it so clear that legal battles in many cases are more about winning a competition than finding the truth or proving or disproving innocence.
Yeah.
Which I love that. I love when we can use the elegance of game design to make, you know, thematic points. The last two games I want to mention that were in the indie Nintendo thing. Light Fingers seemed very cool to me. It's like a board game type thing.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with Hand of Fate, it reminded me a lot of that. So
I watched the trailer, it looks super cool.
Yeah.
It's like this weird kind of world turning thing.
Yeah, so you've got the board, like, which is like a big sort of overworld in a way, and you explore that, and then every now and then you go down into a map or like a level that you've got to navigate. And so in Hand of Fate, that is done with, you know, a deck of cards is sort of your world map, and then every now and then you'll go into a little combat sequence. This looks a little bit close to Mario Party in the terms of the fact that it's on a board, for one thing. But it's also multiplayer. So, like, in the trailer, like, I don't know too much about it, and I don't even know if the multi people playing it are playing cooperatively or competitively.
Mm.
But, for example, there's one point where you go into one of these little levels, and one guy's trying to navigate a trap gauntlet, and the other players are able to manipulate, like, where the saw blades swing in from and stuff like that on the fly. And so there's kind of, like, winding little winches. Because the whole thing has this very, like, clockwork sort of if you think of like the Game of Thrones map,
yeah,
in the opening of Game of Thrones, it's that kind of like, oh, everything's done by gears, and it looks very cool.
That sounds really cool. You mentioned that you can also play it like as on the table kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's something it supports table play mode. So that table play mode is where you take the controllers off the Switch and set the screen down on something else so that you can pass the controllers around. So the three main modes are handheld mode, which is where you're holding it as it is, TV mode, which is where you play it like a traditional console, and this thing that's really sort of portable mode, but it's really sort of shorthand for portable with multiplayer in a lot of ways. And so that would be awesome. That's exactly what I want the Switch for, is that kind of game.
Yeah, then you can go to your cool hipster parties and play with your friends.
Yeah, I can go to a rooftop party and bring listen to whatever the current version of music is while we talk about whether fidget spinners are still cool or whether they're really lame because they used to be, because old people think they're cool. The other game I want to talk about is No More Heroes. So on things that are maybe cool, I don't know.
Certainly a question mark behind that.
Yeah, so if anybody's familiar with No More Heroes, I honestly don't know how widespread the knowledge of this game is, but it was massive on the Wii, like a real kind of cult hit.
Yeah, it kind of helped, like, not really launch, but like the guy
it was one of it was one of the early titles that was like, hell yeah. So Suda51 is not someone I know a lot about outside of this, and the fact that he makes a lot of weird Japanese games.
Yeah, some of them are a bit hit and miss.
Yeah, and so like this is, if you were to, it's very kind of punk, but in a Japanese kind of punk way, and the kind of thing that would make some people really roll their eyes. Like, so in the original No More Heroes, for example, you save the game by taking a shit on the toilet. Yep. And there are people who would be like, ugh, how lame. And I still am a little bit like, ugh, well done, how edgy. But it's actually a very unique game with a lot of character. This is not just some boring sequel, though. What's interesting about this is that Suda51 and whatever his studio is has like partnered with a whole bunch of indies.
Yeah.
And the premise of this game is that Travis Touchtown gets sucked into a magical video game console and has to navigate the world of these other games that exist in the real world. So, for example, Hotline Miami is one of the games.
Really?
So it isn't just like, oh, he gets sucked into a console and then he, you know, like in Tron, where none of the games are real, but you can kind of see, oh, yeah, the light cycles is kind of like Snake or whatever. It's actual indie games that exist. And more than one of them has been confirmed, but unfortunately, No More Heroes, Hotline Miami is the only one I can remember off the top of my head at the moment.
Right.
But yeah, so like they're all kind of, it's kind of ambiguous at the moment whether or not this is just a licensing thing like you would get with a Telltale game, or whether the other game, the companies are actually going to be very heavily involved and make custom content for this collection. You know?
This is either going to be amazing or terrible.
Yeah.
There's no in between.
But this is the thing, right? I'm kind of starved for shit on the Switch, right? Yeah. Like, I don't want to make it sound like there's nothing on it. There's heaps of stuff on it. It's just nothing that's interesting to me. What I really want there to be on the Switch is Portal. I want something like Portal on there that I can do puzzles in.
I think the problem, quotation marks, is if you were into everything that the Switch releases, there's heaps of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you're a person with specific tastes, you're not always going to find everything that comes out enjoyable.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is that a lot of the stuff that's kind of on there that does interest me, I already own on other systems. So I already have Super Meat Boy on PC. Shovel Knight, some people are crazy about that. I'm not a fan of Shovel Knight. But if you were the kind of person who loves the shit out of Shovel Knight, why would you buy it a second time?
Yeah, that's always always the thing
The thing that I can appreciate that you really love a game that I don't like. I have trouble accepting that I should buy something two times.
This is why I kind of double down on the PC because I'm just like, I'm done. I want one place.
And like, there are some games that, like Yooka-Laylee, I'm really keen about that. When is that coming? When is that going to be on the Switch?
Oh, right. I was like, it was out.
I didn't buy it on the PC.
So you could play on the
Switch. I could play it on the Switch, right? And here I am months later, and I still have no idea when that's supposed to come out. Yeah. I wanted to buy that game so bad when they fucking axed JonTron. You have no idea how much I wanted to give those people money after that happened.
I could bet. Maybe you should have bought it twice.
Yeah, I honestly was like, maybe I should buy this game twice. I was going to buy it anyway. I don't think it's much of a statement if I just buy it the same way I would have.
I don't know. That doesn't sound like a game you'll play more than once, but I
doubt I'll finish it once. I think it'll be fun to do like the first two or three maps or whatever.
Anyway.
Look,
hopefully
that
something comes out. I'm sure it'll be fun.
So that's our very Nintendo heavy episode. If you like what we do here on the Slowpoke, mm-hmm. You can find us on iTunes or anywhere else where good podcasts can be acquired.
Yes.
Our website is slowpokespodcast.com, Twitter at slowpokescast, and Facebook, facebook.com/slowpokespodcast.
Definitely. We've also got a YouTube page as well that you can just search for Slowpokes.
Yep. We're not popular enough to have a custom URL there, so you're going to have to use the old-fashioned searching fingers.
We're going to get there one day, but if you go to our website, everything's there.
Exactly. Our next game is Oxenfree.
Yes, Oxenfree. I was super excited to play it. I'm looking forward to it. It's a great time.
Yeah, this is something that I knew very little about before playing it, but I got into it at the behest of John. If you'd like to hear our thoughts, as always, you can find us at all the places we just mentioned.
Yep.
Other than that, John, thank you for podcasting with me.
Oh, David, I'll podcast with you anytime.
That's good to know. That's real comfortable that I've made myself here.
My heart will go on.
Thanks, everybody else, for joining us. Hope you have a great day.
See ya.